We have not talked about the twin factor. What if they get in a fight and his brother tries to sabotage his campaign by doing a guerrilla twin event? I knew twins who pretended to be each other at their college graduations and each officially graduated from a different university. But that could happen on a presidential level.
I would love that.
Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. My name is Galen Druk, former San Antonio mayor and U.S. Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. Julian Castro is running for president. He made it official on Saturday at a rally in San Antonio, and he's one of the youngest people in the field of likely contenders. He'd also be the first Latino nominee of a major party if he were to win the primary. But of course, that is a big if. So we're going to talk about the theory of his case for the Democratic nomination. And here with me to do that are Editor-in-Chief Nate Silver. Hey, Nate, how's it going?
Good. How is it going for you?
It's going well.
We need a sound effect when someone declares.
Tony, can we come up with a sound effect for every time somebody announces for president? He just came on the intercom to say yes. All right, we'll work on it.
It should be someone drinking for a water fountain because it's thirsty.
All right, so as you heard, Nate is here. Claire, senior politics writer, is also here. Claire, how's it going?
Good. Claire Malone, nice to be here.
And managing editor Micah Cohen, how are you?
Hi, everybody.
So also today, we have a new rubric for assessing candidates' pathways to the Democratic nomination, which we're going to discuss. It essentially lays out the different parts of the party that a winning candidate would have to unite. But before we get into any of that, something else notable happened on Saturday. Anyone know?
Some football games.
There was a meeting of some sort?
The current shutdown became the longest shutdown in history.
So, in the United States.
In the United States. That's
Let's
correct.
Let's not be so Americentric.
I mean, I don't know if this counts, but I think Belgium holds the record for the country going the longest period without a government.
How long?
It was over a year, like 500-something days.
See, I want us to write this article.
Terrible rom-com, 500 days of no government.
What happens if the government stays shut down for like 6 more months or a year? Claire, you should write that.
So far, it's been over 23 days. You know, we now have some polling. We can compare when the shutdown began to now. It seems like voters are blaming Trump a little bit more than they were originally. Understanding that, how have the politics changed over the past 3 weeks?
I think the president's not handling this in a very smart way if he wants to look after his own approval rating or how voters view him. His overall approval rating is down to 40.7, disapproval up to 54.3 in our tracker, which is down about a point and a half. So kind of for every week of this, he's losing like half a point in approval rating, gaining half a point in disapproval rating. People have always blamed him and or Republicans more than Democrats for the shutdown. It seems like those numbers may, if anything, be getting a little bit worse. The border wall is also quite unpopular. It seems like those numbers are maybe actually getting a little better because they're kind of converging toward his overall approval rating. But when your overall approval rating is 41%, then that's not a good thing necessarily. And the option of declaring an emergency to force construction of a border wall is even more unpopular. So the president hasn't played his hand well. And some of this is just politics 101, where if you are letting Sean Hannity or Ann Coulter or Rush Limbaugh kind of dictate what your policy is, I mean, you know, first of all, as we talked about after the midterms, I mean, generally the lessons that politicians take from bad midterms is that it's time to at least symbolically pivot toward the center. And Trump is instead letting the rightmost part of his base dictate his agenda, and the consequences are kind of predictably poor for him. So unless something changes and people start blaming Democrats and their polling gets worse, I mean, I don't see why Pelosi and Schumer have any political incentive not to just wait him out. I mean, it seems like it's not getting any better for him. You're going to start to have consequences that are more visible to people at airports or whatever else. And then, you know, I don't really see a good way out of this for President Trump.
You know, I remember at the beginning of the shutdown, I was kind of bored by the story. But the longer it goes on, not only, as you mentioned, Galen, have polls gotten a little worse for Trump, but our friend on the site, Ariel Edwards Levy at HuffPo, wrote about this. The share of people who say that the shutdown is a serious problem has skyrocketed, which isn't totally surprising as it drags on. But the share who said it was very serious started at about 30% and is up just above 50% or at 50%. So it's like a real problem for him. And the fact that we're seeing movement in his approval ratings, as Nate mentioned, is significant. You know, most news stories day to day don't affect Trump's top line approval ratings.
So at this point, is there any obvious conclusion that would be politically palatable to both sides, Claire?
Are you asking me to solve the shutdown?
Yes.
Claire, solve
it. Is it a national emergency?
So what I think might happen is something close to what Lindsey Graham outlined this weekend, and I'm just going to quote Graham here. I would urge him, Trump, to open up the government for a short period of time, like 3 weeks before he pulls the plug. See if we can get a deal. If we can't, at the end of 3 weeks, all bets are off. See if he can do it by himself through the emergency powers. So perhaps something like that, where Trump backs off, shutting down the government. They reopen talks with Pelosi and Schumer. Things kind of died down for him publicly, politically. Because I think what's happened right now is that we are at a heightened moment of scrutiny. And, you know, everyone's kind of backed into their own corners. It's like, you know, it's like getting in a fight with a teenage girl. It's like she's not going to back down because she'll lose face, right? That's what everyone's kind of doing, or any teenager. No one wants to lose face in public. And I think what needs to kind of happen for a politically feasible solution is that things kind of ratchet back down.
Or Trump needs a face-saving measure, whether that's like,
right.
I think, you know,
whatever exactly. He just needs to save face.
Yeah, so maybe that's declaring a national emergency, or maybe it's like, okay, I'm going to move funding from X to Y and reopen the government. And then, you know, 6 months later, whatever he did is nullified by the courts, but at least it gets him out of the
country. Is it really? It means he lost the fight.
We should note, though, he said he doesn't want to pursue a national emergency. That's the most recent comment.
Even if he did, is declaring a national emergency a face-saving measure? I mean, it seems like there are a lot of vocal people within his own party who don't want that.
It's a way to reopen the government without just totally backing
down. Although
at
times he has said, I would declare a national emergency and not reopen the government.
That would be
I mean, look, I think Trump has, like, what he is proposing, you can call it a wall or a fence, right, but steel slats on a few hundred additional miles of the border where they aren't right now, maybe reinforcing them on some other number of miles, right? It's not this giant concrete wall. And in some sense, frankly, you might say, hey, it's a fairly reasonable measure. We already have border defenses in some parts of the border, and this would extend it a bit more in places where it's relatively cost effective to do so, you know. So he has kind of backed down, but like he's just played the negotiations so poorly that, like, number one, he's given Democrats less incentive to compromise by making it clear that he was willing to, like, bear this political cost, you know. I mean, I thought for a while that maybe there could be Democrats approve some measure for border security, right? And Trump says, oh, that's what we wanted, right, when it doesn't actually contain any earmarked funding for the wall. I thought maybe they could take advantage of the fact that Trump can spin things that aren't true necessarily, and so could claim that there was a victory when there wasn't. That seemed like one weird equilibrium that could result. But I don't know. I mean, you know, one outcome is that, like, the consequences become more and more noticeable, and eventually Republicans tell him, hey, look, man, you've got to fold, or else we're going to override your veto.
I need to insert a... not a correction even, but a story broke while I was in a meeting over the last hour that changes the Lindsey Graham suggestion. This is a Times story that says, President Trump said on Monday that he rejected a proposal by Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina to temporarily reopen the government in an effort to jumpstart talks with Democratic lawmakers on funding the border wall. So, not to say that Trump wouldn't eventually go for that plan, but he has rejected that Lindsey Graham proposal.
So what do you guys think are the odds then that Republicans in Congress are like, reopen the government, back down, or we're going to do it ourselves?
Not great. As part of this process, Trump has made the wall more popular than ever amongst Republicans. So is this the thing that lawmakers within his own party would decide to break with him on?
If it gets to a point where, like, there's a video going around today of this, like, incredibly long airport lines, you know, more and more paychecks get missed, it could get to a point where there's acute pain and members
and
of Congress
there's also
are
stuff like,
hearing about
you know,
it.
The number of food inspections are
right.
So maybe the way it ends is that there's some massive E. coli outbreak at a popular fast food chain, which can be arguably linked to the lack of federal funding for certain departments, and then there's some emergency that would, like, force his hand. Maybe in a very weird way, that could be face saving too, because Trump would say, okay, well, we're not willing to put, you know, whatever at risk. But I don't know. I mean, to your point earlier, I've been looking for these pieces maybe we have to write ourselves about, like, what does happen after 2 months instead of 2 weeks, right? And I guess because we've never quite experienced shutdown this long, we aren't sure exactly.
Yeah, I want to know.
Like, you know, my intuition tends to be that, okay, you miss one paycheck and you work through it, and you miss a second paycheck, and number one, you might not have the means to work through it. A lot of people can't miss one paycheck at all, period. But then you're like, you know what?
This shit.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know. So
protest? Is that what your suggestion?
I mean, certainly TSA agents have a lot of leverage, right? And I don't know how sympathetic the public would be, but if they were to say, we're going to go on strike because we haven't been paid. If you're not going to pay me, then sorry, I can't do work for you. I mean, I don't know.
I think as with all things related to maybe shaming Trump into a different position or a less confrontational position, some of this falls to how Republican leadership acts. And I think Graham was kind of like a first foray into trying to broker something more publicly. We've noted before that McConnell has been kind of out of the picture with this. He's letting Trump be out there. I kind of wonder, to Micah's point, we've never seen a shutdown go this long. What does the Republican conference do once it drags on for too long? I mean, is this where they start to say, listen, we have to come to some sort of agreement? Is this when, you know, McConnell gets more vocal? I don't know. But it seems like Graham was kind of like that opening foray. And Graham's already kind of an interesting figure where he can be mouthy either way, pro or con Trump. So,
well, and a couple other, I think like even Ted Cruz made some noise. A couple other people have made some noise. But I guess, look, right now I would bet it's just as likely that they pass some border security. Trump calls it what he wants and both sides sort of halfway back down. You know, that's just as likely as Republicans turning on Trump. The only reason I think that we should entertain the possibility of congressional Republicans turning on Trump in this case, despite them like never doing it ever, is because there is this, it's not quite a ticking time bomb, but it is kind of a ticking time bomb where there's this shutdown that's building and building and building, and the effects of that are building and building and building. And so at a certain point, I think you kind of can't just ignore it. There's an external force that's going to force the issue at some point.
All right. Well, at this point, we don't know what that external force will be. And it seems like we're probably going to be talking about this next week, given that we...
I was so wrong about this story.
Can't see a solution at this point. So given all that, let's move on. And let's talk about the road to the Democratic nomination for Castro and others. But first, let me tell you that today's podcast is brought to you by SelectQuote. If you're thinking about life insurance, did you know that the older you get, the more it costs? That's why locking in your rate for up to 10 or 20 years now makes sense. The rate you lock in won't change, even if your health status does. If you think you can't afford it, chances are SelectQuote can help you get it for less than a dollar a day. SelectQuote comparison shops up to 10 highly rated companies, including Prudential, Banner Life, and Mutual of Omaha, and others, to find you the company with the best rates. Let SelectQuote save you time and money. Get your free quote at selectquote.com/538 today. That's selectquote.com/538 for your free quote today. Get full details on the example policy at selectquote.com/commercials. Your premium could vary depending on your health, issuing company, and other factors, and it's not available in all states. Don't put off protecting your family another day. selectquote.com/538.
Do you guys have life insurance?
I was just thinking that. No.
I don't think I do.
I don't. Well,
I have no will.
I don't have a will either.
What is your dog going to do?
I'm going to make a will. I'll leave something to each of you guys in it.
Oh, that's so nice.
Who wants my dog?
Well, you can get life insurance and then make us the beneficiaries of your life insurance.
I want no animals in my apartment.
Okay, let's continue with the show. And before we talk about Julian Castro specifically, Nate, you devised a rubric for assessing candidates' strengths in the Democratic primary. So lay it out for us. What are the five corners of the Democratic Party?
You know, I don't know how this corner thing became popularized.
I think it was a Micah thing.
So I do not endorse that language.
Wait, what do you mean? I saw the piece. It's like there are five corners.
It's a pentagram assigned to the Masons.
They're the mainstream. It's where all things flow from these five groups, right? So the argument of the piece is that there are five major constituencies.
Tributaries.
Tributaries.
Vectors.
Ooh.
Corners.
Anyway, there are five groups. Here are the groups. Number one, what I call party loyalists. So these are mostly older, usually upper middle class voters, big Hillary Clinton supporters. They're pro-establishment, pro-electability, generally play it pretty safe, and have a very, in the mainstream kind of capital D part of the Democratic Party. So they're a little bit more moderate than some of the other groups. Number two is the left. So it's the roughly 25% of the Democratic electorate thought that Hillary Clinton was not liberal enough, even though she had a kind of conventional liberal track record. So that's a big constituency, obviously, that went to Bernie last time. Number three is what I call millennials and friends. So we saw a huge age split in who people voted for in 2016, where Sanders won overwhelmingly among people aged roughly 35 and younger, and Clinton won overwhelmingly among older voters. And there are a lot more voters older than 35 than under 35. But still, it crosses different racial groups and other and different genders. But there is a big split between the sorts of candidates that appeal to a 45-year-old and a 33-year-old or something. Group number four is black voters. And group number five is Hispanic voters, sometimes grouped with Asian voters because they have some things in common, although it doesn't work for all purposes. And the idea is that of those five groups, so party loyalists, the left, millennials, blacks, Hispanics, you have to win three out of those five to have a majority coalition.
So you're saying they're all about weighted equally if you can
yeah,
get
I mean,
any
if
three
you go,
out of five.
If you go through the, you know, I think if you actually, we actually go through and try to estimate how big the groups are, I think the group called party loyalists is actually the biggest group. You know, we peg it at 30% of the electorate. And you can be in more than one group, by the way. And you can also, there also are a few voters here who slip through the cracks.
So Claire and Micah, do you think this is a good way of analyzing how to win a majority within a Democratic primary? I mean, is this how you guys see it when you assess candidates?
At the risk of being a brown noser, I think this is a very helpful, like, first shot into analyzing what is going to be a very crowded Democratic primary. Obviously, like, these different groups, tributaries, vectors, whatever you want to call them,
corners,
have, you know, different numbers, different rates of how much they turn out. But in general, when we're talking about, okay, it's a really crowded field, the party has gone through a lot of changes and sort of an identity crisis over the past couple of years, they're going to be competing factions, you're going to need to win a coalition of voters. Who's your coalition? I think this is a useful kind of, it almost makes it into a little bit of like the Settlers of Catan of the Democratic primary. It's like, which coalition
to
win?
This just got real nerdy.
No, but I mean it in the sense of, for the past couple of years, I've found it irritating the way a lot of media have broken down. Will the Democrats do, and it started right after 2016, will the Democrats do identity politics or economic politics, right? I think that this helps people be smarter about thinking about how candidates will message themselves, right? So it's like, yes, we are trying to appeal to white suburban people, but also we know that we have a big black coalition and the way we talk about race has changed. So who's the candidate who's going to do that? I actually do find it like a helpful thing, and I do think people should check it out. And it is not because Nate is my boss. It's because he wrote a good piece.
No, it is good.
Thank you, Micah. The editor of the story.
I did edit
Micah
it.
Cohen.
Dream team over here.
What I would say, though, is that, so one reason I think it works is the Democratic Party is more coalitional than the Republican Party,
yes.
Right? The Republican Party is the Republican Party is much more homogenous. The Democratic Party is more made up of these groups. So I think in that way it works. But the other thing is, and Nate says this in the piece, just to take a step back for a second, I think this is a good way to try to understand the primary and the field and what might happen. But it's just one way. So like in 2016, the 2016 Republican primary, we defaulted to the party decides view of understanding what might happen in the primary, right? The party decides being party insiders, elected officials, party operatives, move resources and exert influence to pick a nominee, right? That obviously didn't happen with the Republican Party in 2016. Happened with the Democratic Party. But so this year we're going to try and entertain multiple hypotheses basically at once. So one is this, one item, whatever we're calling it, the five corners hypothesis, which is like, okay, whichever candidate can piece together the broadest coalition among these coalitions will win. But we're also going to do other ones. You know, who's to say the party won't? The party could decide. Or maybe one thing we're talking about is maybe the most anti-Trump candidate will win. So which candidate draws the biggest contrast with Trump, right? And if you look at the field by these different, you know, hypotheses, I think different candidates will come out looking better or worse, which is a good way to kind of keep yourself honest and not get ahead of yourself.
Yeah, so I want to get into how the candidates look according to this theory. But before we do that, I mean, you said there's many different ways to assess candidate strengths in the Democratic primary. This largely seems to be focused on identity within the party. The left has to do with policy, but apart from that, these corners do not necessarily have to do with specific policies. When we looked at the Republican Party in 2016, a lot of it was focused more on, you know, this is the Christian conservatives, this is the, you know, moderate establishment, et cetera, et cetera. So, Nate, why, when we look at the Democrats, are we more focused on identity than, say, policy?
Well, look, I think journalists sometimes have this kind of misconception that people, like, have an issue matrix where they look at, like, here are my 12 issues and here's where the candidates line up, and it's not nearly that linear. You know, why people support candidates is kind of a complex soup of who you agree with on the issues, who you think would make a good president, who you think can get elected, who you think has your back, who you identify with. And just so you notice, because, you know, to some extent, when you have 15 candidates, however many we're going to have, right, it's a market to keep your attention. So one answer is that, like, that's how politics works. And the other one is, you know, empirically, if you kind of break down the past few nominations, then these groups do a pretty good job of describing the way the vote splits, right? Parties in America are big tent parties. There are only two major parties, and so they include all these groups that may not agree that much on everything. Although, weirdly, you know, I don't think they're going to be big, huge policy debates among Democrats, really.
So you think identity will guide a lot of the...
I don't think that's true.
Okay, so Claire disagrees.
So I think that there will be some policy debates between the pretty large caucus of people who have said, I'm a progressive and I believe in Medicare for all, and people who won't go that far, who will say, yikes, that's like a Biden type. Yikes, that's not super plausible right now. Let's talk about healthcare, but let's talk about it in a different way. I do think that there will be those debates.
Yeah. Yeah, I tend to agree with that. Whether those debates affect voters' decisions.
Yeah.
But they'll find something to argue about.
The one thing I think is interesting that you point out in the piece, Nate, but it doesn't show up necessarily in the five groups thing, is just the way that, like, let's take black voters, the way younger black voters often have different views or exhibit different political preferences than older black voters. He says in the piece, but it's not when you're looking at just at the diagram, you know, there are splits of, like, well, younger black millennials might be pulled by two different things, and who do they go to? So there are lots of nuances within that.
And they may have distinct policy preferences,
correct,
compared,
yeah,
with their...
And for Hispanic voters and for Asian voters. Because traditionally the idea was, oh, actually, you know, African Americans are sort of socially conservative, right? Not necessarily so much true if you're a 23-year-old African American. Oh, Hispanic voters, you know, they're family values voters. Again, not necessarily true if you're 24-year-old Hispanic instead. Although they're also not necessarily, like, there is not necessarily that much support for kind of Bernie Sanders type socialism either. And so I know, but you get into these things like for Bernie Sanders, who historically has not been the first choice of very many black or Hispanic voters. You know, why is that exactly? Is that a matter of identity? He's an old guy from Vermont, Jewish guy, you know, is it because socialism doesn't have a lot of appeal? I mean, I don't know, right?
Yeah. So I think it's fair to say that this is complicated, but according to the rubric that we do have, how do the various candidates do? Were you guys, Micah, Claire, surprised by any of their performances?
Yeah, I was actually.
Yeah, I was surprised at how bad Biden and Sanders did.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I was surprised by how well someone like Kamala Harris.
Or Beto.
Yeah, it did.
And just to make clear to listeners, so basically Nate went through and scored each candidate according to their strength with each of these five groups and then charted it. And so you can see basically from a starting point how big each candidate's coalition looks.
Right.
Well, I would describe it more as who has the most upside with which groups?
So maybe we just mentioned a few. Nate shows that Biden, for instance, pulls really well with party, would do well with party loyalists, maybe, you know, traditional black voter coalition, but that's kind of his main sway. Sanders has kind of the, I guess, sort of like the flip side of it, which is he does really well with the left and millennials. But then someone like Harris is doing well with black voters and party loyalists and Hispanic and Asian voters and a little bit of the millennial things. And Beto kind of like a similar.
Yeah. So Harris is a good example of why I think it's better to think about this about in terms of upside rather than actual support. Like Harris is polling at about what, like 10% in polls. So this is more saying, okay, based on how she's performed in California, based on national polls, based on just frankly Nate's judgment, what groups will Harris have the most appeal with, upside with, you know, but then she has to kind of execute on that upside. So to be clear, this could be wrong on two levels, right? It could be wrong in the sense that, like, maybe these aren't the best five groups to think about, or maybe, you know, maybe there's a big split among black voters, or maybe age, this primary isn't a dividing line like it was in 2016. But even if that's right, this isn't foolproof, right? We're saying right now, we don't think Biden, for example, has a lot of upside with the left. Well, that makes sense to me. And I understand, maybe Nate can talk about why he did that. But I don't know. It's not out of the question that he builds that support, right?
Yeah, although I think Biden is kind of semi-explicitly running as a
moderate, like a general election moderate.
Yeah.
Although, again, like kind of what that means, you know, would it be shocking if Biden embraced Medicare for All? I think I was looking this up. I think he has been skeptical about it, right? But it wouldn't be shocking if that's just direction that the party is going overall. What is weird is I don't think there's an explicitly moderate group within these five corners. The kind of party loyalists are a bit more moderate, and some of the older black and Hispanic voters are a bit more moderate. But like, there's not like a lot of rhetorical calls for moderation. You know, I mean, Terry McAuliffe is one exception. McAuliffe is explicitly like, oh, we got to move to the center, right? And like some of these, you know, I was looking up John Delaney, the congressman from Maryland who declared, he's kind of explicit like, oh, we just need more bipartisanship, right?
Ojeda.
Well, Ojeda is, I don't know how to classify him.
Conservative.
He's not, though.
Like, yeah, like
but
he's
economically
he's like
the left.
He's for, yeah, exactly. Economically the left. He's for, like, legalization of marijuana. Yeah. But from an identity, for sure, he's trying to appeal to a more, like,
he's
conservative.
Like, you can like guns and support Medicare for All.
Right. It is the white identity play.
But the group of moderates, I think, is a good example of where this could go wrong. That was Perry's first question about this, is like, we don't have, as a power center in the Democratic primary, you know, let's say white moderates. If they do end up being a force of gravity in the primary, then maybe Biden does better than
and
we
right.
Think.
I mean, I think right now we put white moderates with, we would put them under like party loyalists.
Party loyalists, yes.
Which is interesting because we spent a lot of time talking about suburban women during the midterms, and many of those people may have either identified as independents or have voted Republican in the past. So it would be hard, therefore, to categorize them
as party loyalists.
Party loyalists.
Right.
Fair enough. So as the primary plays out, we will check back in with this and see how these, I don't know, are they projections of as to the upside of particular candidates? It's not really projections.
I think this
but,
is like a pre-poll theory of the case for different, for the primaries, for different candidates.
That's a good way to think about it.
And since we're kind of describing this as an alternative to polls, I think it's worth asking as we wrap up, Nate, how meaningful are polls at this point, just as a baseline for people who are seeing new polls come out and maybe weighing that against what we have here?
I mean, I think if you look back at polls in the period from like now through June, historically they predict the winner like half the time, which is actually pretty decent. Although your betting average is going to be way lower than 50 in a field where you have, number one, so many candidates. Number two, you know, Biden is not an overwhelming front runner. He's at about 25-ish% in polls, right? That's okay. But like for someone who was the vice president for 8 years and has universal name recognition, it's not terrific. And so, but you know, but look, I think people have these hot takes. Oh, the polls aren't that predictive. Well, I mean, if you want to like literally try to put that into like a formula, I mean, someone polling at 25% is a lot more likely to win empirically than someone polling at 2.5%.
But I would the way you asked that question, Galen, which is how would you weigh the polls against this? I really would recommend people do exactly that. You know, look at the polls. What do they say? Weigh them against, you know, Nate's scoring on this thing. Weigh that against, you know, how the candidates are racking up endorsements or raising money. Weigh that against, you know, who's the starkest contrast with Trump, maybe. Weigh that against how the candidates appear on the trail, who's the best campaigner. There is not a foolproof way to predict who's going to win the primary. I think that's right, Nate?
I would certainly think, given that it's been hard to predict some of these primaries.
So, like, the best you can do is, you know, what we're going to try to do. And we're going to publish stuff on all this, which is like, okay, let's form a hypothesis about how this primary will work, grade and evaluate the candidates based on that, and then see how things develop and make falsifiable, you know, predictions.
All right. Nate, you mentioned candidates polling at 2.5%, and that is actually a perfect segue into our next segment, which is about Julian Castro's case for being the Democratic nominee. So let's talk about that. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by Quip. The new year means new resolutions, and here's one to work on twice every day. It's your oral health, and with a Quip electric toothbrush, sticking to good habits is simple. The guiding features are like a built-in support system for better brushing. Quip has sensitive sonic vibrations for an effective clean that's gentle on your sensitive gums. It's an important feature because people can brush too hard, and some electric toothbrushes are too abrasive. The built-in 2-minute timer pulses every 30 seconds to remind you when to switch sides and help you clean your whole mouth evenly. Quip is a simple way to get into a good habit, and that's why 1 million happy, healthy mouths love Quip. Quip starts at just $25, and if you go to getquip.com/538 right now, you can get your first refill pack for free. That's getquip, GETQUIP.com/538, the numbers, to get your first refill pack free. Today's podcast is also brought to you by Upstart. Applying for a loan is a lot like applying for a job that you don't get to interview for. Instead, loan companies make their decisions based off your credit score and history without getting to know the whole you. Now, thanks to Upstart.com, it never has to be that way again. Upstart is revolutionizing the way you borrow money by rewarding you for your job experience and education in the form of a smarter interest rate. Unlike traditional credit underwriting, which could be biased against people with a short credit history, Upstart goes beyond the traditional FICO score when assessing your credit worthiness. Over 10,000 people have used Upstart to pay off credit cards, student loans, fund their wedding, or make a large purchase. Hurry to upstart.com/politics to find out how low your Upstart rate is. Checking your rate only takes 2 minutes and it won't affect your credit. That's Upstart, UPSTART.com/politics. Okay, this is the second installment of a segment we're calling The Theory of the Case. And today our focus is Julian Castro because he announced on Saturday. So just to kind of get the lay of the land, where is he situated in the field of likely contenders based on his ideology and background, Claire?
He's more on the outside, right? Like, he is not one of the people who's running as U.S. Senator, which means, for lack of a better way of saying it, he doesn't have a national profile. He was a member of the Obama administration. He was the HUD secretary, Housing and Urban Development. He kind of has been laying low for the past couple of years of the Trump administration, so he might not have high name recognition. But in general, I would say, if we're going back to our original groups, his theory of the case for the primary would be that he appeals to Latino voters. He is Latino. And he is, he's an Obama administration guy. He's probably going to attract more of a party establishment type of person. He is not an outsider. He was formerly the mayor of San Antonio, so he's got some, I really hesitate to call it, like, small town cred, real America cred, because it's like a really big city. But he's got, like, outside Washington governmental experience, you know, that kind of thing. So that's kind of his theory of the case. I call him an outside shot just in part because he's not well known. He hasn't had a national profile for a while. Obviously, we have a couple of years to go.
Yeah. Well, yeah, in some ways, he's sort of regressed a little bit, I think, in terms of his public profile. He gave the keynote speech at the 2012 Democratic Convention and was seen as like the new up-and-coming young thing, a little bit like Obama himself had been giving a speech at the, what was it, the 2004 convention. But like, look, if you're a cabinet member, you're not really that high profile, even probably like a member of the House. You have a few House members running, I guess, are a little bit more high profile. They're at least kind of weighing in on contemporary legislation and so on and so forth. And so, you know, so he's got to like rebuild his profile. I mean, look, in some ways, the candidates who have declared early, in some sense, it's candidates who are a little weaker and therefore want to get out in front of it to maximize the amount of time they have to hire people, to build their name recognition, to see if there's a market for them. You know, we talked about Elizabeth Warren, for example. She had really been in the news because of this DNA test that everyone thought she botched, right? So it's kind of like because of that, you want to declare sooner instead of letting yourself get lapped. And I don't know. I mean, you know, for as many Democratic candidates as there are not that many with Hispanic ancestry. Castro is one. And Garcetti, the mayor of Los Angeles, is partly of Mexican descent, so he might be two if he were to run too. Eric Garcetti. But like, that's a pretty natural basis to start out with. But it's also like his message, apart from that, in the speech yesterday, I didn't watch, I read accounts of it, you know, seems a little generic otherwise. You know, you kind of wonder why he isn't leaning more into immigration or something, right? So it's kind of like a little bit of an empty vessel right now.
Which has its advantages, I guess you could say, historically, if we're going for pros for Castro, is that he doesn't have a lot of stated policy positions on a lot of things that are kind of in the news. And so you can, this is kind of like the Obama mold coming in, is that he just had a shorter record in national politics. So that's, I guess, advantageous. It can be advantageous sometimes to be a slightly empty vessel.
To be a cipher, yeah.
No, I mean, totally. He literally has like no voting record, basically.
Well, I was looking at his On the Issues score, and you know, they have that kind of chart, and they had him put right in the middle as like a moderate. I was like, holy shit. But then I looked, and it's because he has like three statements graded. So he really, you know, you guys said this, but he doesn't have many sort of like mile markers planted down in terms of where he is. But again, like, look, two-thirds, I think one poll found two-thirds of likely Democratic voters didn't have an opinion of him. So he has plenty of potential and time to...
A lot of candidates have no national name recognition. Like, right. I don't think that... He's not unique in that sense.
The one thing I'd say, though, is one of our writers, Jeff Skelly, wrote about this, but Castro, you know, has sort of angered some progressive groups. They, you know, he's been accused of being too friendly with Wall Street, a little too cozy with San Antonio's business community. The other thing I would say is, like, have you guys watched the convention speech he gave in 2012?
In 2012.
Well, maybe.
You know,
I watched it
in 2012, probably live from the...
But it's
like, I don't know if you know, it's kind of a big deal.
Because Obama had given that speech in 2004 and then became president, I think people started to think of that speaking slot as like, oh my gosh, it's a stepping stone.
It's like the State of the Union response.
Exactly.
Hey, so, where's the young Kennedy now?
So then Castro gave the speech and it's like, it wasn't Obama's speech. It was a perfectly fine speech, but it was not.
It's like classic political parties, no matter what stripe, like small C conservative plays, to be like, oh my God, this worked last time. It'll work this time.
It's exactly right. It's like, oh, we had a non-white candidate give this speech before and it skyrocketed him. Let's try that again. Yeah. You know, and it's like,
it sounds like we're getting into theories for why he's going to lose already. But before we go fully into why he's going to lose, when Claire introduced Castro referencing Nate's five groups, you said that he could do well with Latinos and also potentially the party establishment because of his ties to Obama. If we're saying that he needs three groups or three corners in order to win, where does he get support from for that third corner?
Millennials and friends.
Yeah.
Maybe black voter, because sometimes the party. But yeah, that'd be the way he would win would. I mean, first of all, I think he has to do some convincing of Hispanic voters too, and in general in this piece we kind of assume that if you're of a certain race you're going to have high potential to appeal to voters of that race, but you know, it's not totally guaranteed. I remember talking to like a friend of a friend who's a very kind of influential Latina Democrat, and she was behind Kamala Harris. She kind of said, you know, I guess I feel obligated to give Castro a look because, you know, he's the only Hispanic running, but like, to be honest, you know, I kind of think that Kamala Harris is the candidate that I'm more interested in potentially. And so there could be a little bit of that. And again, the advantage to him potentially declaring early is we will see if there is an appetite for that. But I don't know. I mean, you know, some of these candidates, Gillibrand is another one where I can't quite figure out who she's trying to appeal to. And you could see her appealing to any of these constituencies. I mean, she has like a lot of support from Black and Hispanic voters in New York. She does well among women, you know. So one reason, by the way, to go through this rubric, by the way, is to try and be like a little bit more rigorous about forcing yourself not just think about the groups that you hear the most from, right? I mean, who you hear a lot from if you're following politics Twitter is you kind of hear a lot of the party establishment folks, and you hear a lot from the left going back and forth with one another, both of whom are maybe the whitest two groups in the party. And so that can lead you to forget that, like, it's a giant, enormously important thing in an electorate where roughly 40% of the Democratic electorate is non-white to be able to, I mean, you can win with mostly white voters, but it's awfully tough. You
I don't think have that's much. An important point. And we, in our discussion last week on the podcast about would sexism sink Warren, Nate made the good counterpoint that female candidates did do pretty well in 2018. So maybe we're thinking about it in a wrong-headed way, or there's this narrative of Democrats need like a white man to be more appealing. Well, maybe it's also Black voters, minority voters feel more activated. So it's kind of like, I think it is a good exercise to think about through whom our information is mediated. Because a lot of, to the point of like, it's you're hearing from a lot of party establishment people on Twitter, there is also like, I think it's kind of fair to say that a lot of mainstream news organizations tend to have that like editorial tone of establishment. Like, this is how it has been, in part because we rely on historical trends to guide us. And we, and you know, we used to live in a party decides era.
The other thing I'd say, though, is, you know, in the general election, Latino voters, in terms of the Electoral College, are like inefficiently distributed because they're all in a, you know,
couple
they're
not, states.
You know, they're concentrating in a couple of states. I haven't done this analysis, but I would imagine for the primaries, you don't have that problem. You know, with especially with California being on Super Tuesday this year, if Castro can lock up, let's say,
Nevada?
You know, Nevada, and then, but I guess my point is just Hispanic voters might be a more valuable constituency in the Democratic primary than in the general election. I mean, they clearly are,
but with
more so.
With California and Texas having moved up when they voted, Texas is one of the first big group of states on, I think, March 7th, or I don't know what date exactly, right? But there'll be a lot of focus on Texas and California. I mean, a little bit of the elephant in the room is like, you know, I think Castro and Beto have coalitions that overlap more than some do, certainly. And so, you know, so I don't know how they're going to handle one another necessarily.
They're competing for resources in that state as far as funding goes.
For sure. In Texas, we saw there is a lot of Democratic money in Texas because Texas is a big state. And it might only be 43% blue, but still 43% of a big wealthy state is a lot of money. And so, you know, it's again why like kind of Castro, I think it's a little bit like Warren and Sanders.
I just said something about mediating through like an establishment mindset. And I think we should think about it from the different angle, which is, okay, so maybe he didn't have a campaign announcement that broke through. But if his proposition is to appeal to Latino voters, that is kind of like an under appealed to constituency. And maybe part of his proposition in, you know, early primary states like Nevada or just in general is saying, I'm going to activate this constituency in a way that it's never been activated before as a mainstream Latino candidate, and in the age of Trump, and that is going to be like a real game changer for Democrats. Like, that could be his proposition, is that I'm going to make a historic play for Latino voters, because we should note that the Latino voters were kind of disappointing for Clinton in 2016, which she didn't expect because of Trump's rhetoric on immigration.
And we could get to, you know, March, basically, California and Texas, and there could still be 10 candidates in the field.
Right. And it's,
and 27% of the vote, or 22% of the vote, could win,
For people interested also in the Latino vote factor in all of this, I would recommend reading Perry Bacon Jr.'s recent piece where he lays out the power of the Latino vote in, you know, recent elections, and basically says in places like Texas and Florida, a third of Latino voters are voting for Republicans, and that they are a huge factor in allowing Republicans to win those states. So maybe that's the argument that he makes.
That's a really good point. To Claire's point, Latino voters are not Black voters.
Yeah. There's
a sizable portion who do not vote Democratic. You know, on top of that, their turnout rates are disproportionately low. So if they can if Castro can help Democrats move, there's plenty of room to move them more to be more Democratic leaning, but also increase turnout. That could have a big effect.
Yeah, the Latino vote. This is an entire different episode, but there's a lot of interesting stuff to talk about, like generationally aging into voting,
yeah.
Especially in California and Texas. Those are the two big states to look at.
It's hard to win the Democratic nomination. There's going to be a lot of people fighting for
it. But I'm on record as saying the twin factor is the X factor.
You can increase your stamina. You just sub one out, right?
Yeah. Like,
do two events simultaneously and don't know anyone.
All right. Well, I think that is a wrap for Julian Castro. Nate, thank you for all this fun today.
Thank you for letting me enjoy the fun with you, dear listener.
And Claire, thanks a bunch to you.
Thanks, Galen.
And Micah, thank you.
You're welcome.
My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. And we got a couple of questions on this topic, actually, so I'll say it here, that you can expect this podcast to come out twice a week. Usually we have an episode on Monday, of course, and another episode out probably on Thursday, but sometimes we'll have emergency podcasts that will, you know, be on different days. So, you know, just check your feed. And in general, you can expect two podcasts. All right, that's it for today. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you soon.